The Fancy Film Fellows employs a frank discussion of cinema that includes adult language and descriptions of mature situations. We have no concern for spoilers, so be warned, you might learn more than you'd care to know.
What's your name, boy?
C.W. Moss.
Well, I'm Miss Bonnie Parker. And this here's Mr. Clyde Barrow. We rob banks.
Is that all there is to my childhood?
Hey, everybody. It's another Fancy Film Fellows podcast coming with you. And I am on this podcast that I was almost not on at all.
Yeah.
But we are here.
Last minute substitution.
Yeah.
For an injured player.
Yeah.
The backup is in. Everybody run for your lives.
Sixth man of the year award.
Yeah, so today we're going to be doing a little activity that we've dubbed Fay-F-I. We're going to be discussing the work of Miss Faye Dunaway. And in particular, the movies that she's in that are on the AFI Top 100.
Three of them.
Yep, wow. three of them. She's got a pretty good average there. But the movies that we're going to be discussing are 1976's Network, directed by Sidney Lumet, 1967's Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, and 1974's Chinatown, directed by Roman Polanski. And here with me today are Ruben.
Hello. I'll just say a couple things. One, this is a re-recording because of my audio messing up on a previous iteration for this. And then, like Patrick mentioned, Ilya had to call out, which is also why this podcast was scheduled at kind of a weird time. So I will probably have to leave in the middle unless everybody only has like a short amount of things to say about these movies, which is possible because I don't think any of us have watched any of them in at least a month when we originally recorded them.
Yeah, it took us a little while to reschedule this recording, and because of that,
I mean, that was mostly my fault. I kept trying things like once or twice a week to try to save my audio based on some forums that I was reading about my audio recording device, and then eventually I gave up.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, you know, these things happen. It's I'm also very sleepy, which is not ideal for this podcast.
Basil, Basil's also with us.
Here sleepy I am.
Basil.
Yeah, I worked late last night. Had to close, so I went to bed after 3. And then my wonderful CPAP machine that helps me breathe in the night did not work properly. Maybe the cat turned it off. Or something, but
very rude I know to do that.
She's always walking all over everything. She's got no boundaries, that cat.
She has cat boundaries.
Cats need to learn. They need to learn personal space. So we are, and in my case, I haven't watched any of these movies in probably a year at least, in the case of all of them, but I have seen all of them before, so I was they were like, you've seen these movies, right? Get in there. Get in there, kid.
It's going to be like that time when Steve Urkel gets put in the game and he's amazing at basketball. You're going to blow us all out of the water.
You've read the playbook, right?
All right, well, let's start with talking about 1976's Network, directed by Sidney Lumet. Now, whose movie was this?
We're starting with mine because I have to leave first, and then we're going in chronological order, I guess.
Yeah.
We're starting with last, and then we're going in chronological order. Mm-hmm. So Network is a movie that I can't remember my exact impetus to watch it, but I'm pretty sure it was because it was on AFI's Top 100. And it was a movie that very much fit sensibilities of burgeoning cinephile Ruben, because I probably saw it sometime between like 15 and 18 years old, and then watched it multiple times after that. And it had all sorts of things that I really liked at the time, like very big acting, like great, like, you know, speech, very quotable speeches. In fact, the centerpiece speech from Howard Beale, in which he is mad as hell, was something that I memorized.
Nice.
And performed for my first girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And she, like, politely clapped.
Yeah, that's better than me, I think, when I was, I mean, I was a little bit younger than a teenager, but I memorized Bill Pullman's speech in Independence Day at the end.
I don't think I memorized it, but I watched it enough, and I thought it was so good that I definitely, you know, had, like, bits of it, like, in my memory.
Yeah. Yeah, my sister and I were really obsessed with it, and, like, we watched it over and over again to try and memorize it.
I think one of my early childhood disappointments was finding out that it was just, what is it, like, Henry V or something like that? Like, mm-hmm. It's a very similar speech, or like maybe whole parts are just directly ripped from it, and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Stupid Shakespeare.
Shakespeare. taking everything. He took everything. Took it too early.
And something that young Ruben would not have been aware of, this movie has a faint whiff of misogyny going on.
Yeah.
that probably also played into my ideas of wanting to be a strong man, and the men are really the important characters in this movie, in spite of the fact that
man.
This is we're discussing Faye Dunaway. So when I rewatched it, it turns out that, as you might guess from the way I discussed it, that the things that I used to like about the movie are the things that I consider its worst qualities. Like, I would say one of the major themes of the movie, as delivered several times by the news producer, who is ostensibly the main character played by William Holden, Max Schumacher, is that life isn't like a television show. There are real people with real problems, which is true, but then the movie writes everything in such a writerly dramatic way
right.
that it really undercuts the idea that he's right. Like, mm-hmm. the movie feels like it could have been from Faye Dunaway's Diana's perspective, like how she sees the world. And maybe that would even be a more interesting movie where it starts off with her instead of with him, and slowly over the course of the movie it becomes like more realistic over time, and the writerly elements, that might be an interesting direction to take a remake if someone wanted to remake Network for like the YouTube age.
Get Todd Phillips on the horn. He clearly has a lot of fandom from it, based on Joker.
Oh, Lord.
With a lot of, you know, you could have Howard Beale go from being, like, a fired CNN news anchor to, like, an alt-right Adam Jones-type talking head.
Alex, yeah.
He could just be PewDiePie or something.
Yeah.
YouTuber.
Yeah, a famous Twitcher who becomes... creepy YouTuber when he gets kicked off of Twitch for ironic Nazi jokes. What the movie does confirm for me is that I really do think Sidney Lumet is quite a good director. My opinion on Paddy Chayefsky as a writer is more mixed, but Sidney Lumet is one of those directors who I think is probably less heralded than he should be, because his cinematography is never showy. Like, it's not the... It doesn't draw attention to the ways in which it's good, but he does a lot of subtle things in terms of how he places the camera to really make moments land in a way in which they might a less functional director... Mm-hmm. For me, the big scene that I felt this way about was the sort of breakup scene between Max and his wife, when he tells her that he's been having an affair.
Mm-hmm.
with a younger woman, how the scene kind of starts off where, like, Max is very big in frame and close to the camera, and, like, the door sort of, like, chops his wife in half, you know, and, like, we're having trouble seeing her, but then it's, like, she sort of takes the reins in the fight, even, like, even if she's playing into what, like, he expected, like, she stands up and she sort of takes control over the frame, but she never really, like, he's always still, like, in the foreground and bigger, and his performance mm-hmm. is, like, so even-keeled that it's kind of like her hysterics aren't able, like, she tries to take over the scene, but mm-hmm. ends up failing. And I was like, you know, there are a lot of directors who would have taken this sort of histrionic writing and mm-hmm. come up with something worse. And in this case, like, it feels like very desperate and, like, sort of sad.
Yeah.
In a way
Oh, I was just going to say, I remember I used to have a writing teacher in college, and she always talked about this one scene in the Woody Allen movie, Another Woman, where she confronts the titular main character, the not other woman, confronts her husband about his affair, and it's played by Ian Holm, and he just says, "I accept your condemnation," and he says it in, like, such a flat, like, non-emotional way. And she always talked about how that was, like, one of the most heartbreaking moments for her in movies, because it's like this woman trying to get in emotionally with this guy, and the guy's like, "I accept your condemnation," like, just like, you know, that he's not going to apologize or, like, re-get emotionally involved in the moment, but he also won't deny that he's doing the things that he's doing. He's just like, "Yeah, that's me. I'm not sure if I'm in love with this woman," but I'm talking about I'm back to Network now, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I'm in love with this woman, but I am going to leave you for her.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, to sort of transition it to Faye Dunaway's character and performance, I think the whatever about the movie isn't misogynistic is due to the acting and Lumet's direction and not the script. Like, I think a worse director would have delivered that scene more straight and would have made her scarier and, like, emotionally manipulative or, like, emotionally fragile or something like that. But the way in which, even though he's being reprimanded, it still comes off as the powerful one in that scene, is more accurate, I think, to real-world power dynamics.
You know, right.
She probably relies on his money to live, for instance.
She doesn't.
And I think that's the case with Faye Dunaway's character, who seems like a very obvious sort of, like, scold for working women. Like, that they basically give her, like, almost meanly, like, these male characteristics. Like, she orgasms really quickly. Like, she, you know, has trouble, like, actually falling in love and being vulnerable and letting people in. All she wants to do is work. And,
yeah, like, there's, like, a joke scene where when they have sex, she's literally talking about work the entire time. They're, like, at dinner, she's talking about work. They're walking back to the hotel room, she's talking about work. She's undressing, talking about work. And then, like, even while they're doing it, she's still talking about work. It's, like, a very, obvious joke.
Yeah, and then, like, you think maybe, like, after she comes, that she's going to stop talking about work for a second. But she's like, Anyway, so the thing about the fall numbers is that if we can, you know, switch these two time slots, I think it'll really increase our viewership on Thursday nights or whatever. yeah, it's a really disappointingly badly written character, because there are some things thematically that are interesting about this movie about money and controlling the media and the idea of, like, how revolutions can be bought via just, you know, by letting them in, like, being like, you know, the only thing that you can't say on television is that it's all run by the same money.
Yeah.
And that money is all that matters. Yeah. Like, that's the only thing that's not allowed. But, you know, you can have a pro-communist show on a, you know, losing money on a Friday night primetime slot as long as it's Saudi billionaires who are financing it.
Yeah, I like the part when they're having an argument about what to put in the show, and Faye Dunaway just says that she doesn't give a damn about the political content, just as long as, like, people are watching it, and, you know, they want those hits, man.
It's not a greatly delivered character arc, because it basically boils down to two scenes, but when she meets with the communist leader about having the, like, guerrilla forces who have been robbing banks be on her show, she's very confrontational about it when they first meet, but then the second time we see her, she's just trying to get her percentages from reruns of the show.
Yeah.
And that's, like, the most important thing to her, is that she gets her money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what happens once they let you in, then you're part of it. You're like, ooh, this is going to be cool. Like, I'm going to get my revolutionary ideas on television. And then next thing you know, you're just a capitalist like everybody else.
So, you know, I think Dunaway brings a lot of depth to the character that isn't actually on the page. I think she pushes it beyond what Chayefsky wrote. This one scene that just continues to stick with me in her line delivery where, you know, everyone centers, like, the actor who plays Howard Beale and his performance. I think he's the one who won for this movie.
He did indeed.
Peter Finch. Mm-hmm. And so he delivers this big central speech, which, you know, obviously did stick with me as a kid, but makes less of an impression now. But what also I really liked as a kid and still like now is her right after that speech, when she, like, runs up to the phone banks where people are calling, and she's like, "Who do you have on the phone?" And it's like, "Omaha." And she's like, "Are they yelling in Omaha?" And they're like, "They're yelling." She goes, "They're yelling in Omaha." And then it's like, "What about you, Tucson?" And they're like, "Yeah, we got Tucson on the phone." It's like, "Are they yelling in Tucson?" Like, "They're yelling in Tucson." And she goes, "We've hit the mother load." And she, like, throws all her papers in the air. And I'm like, it's a very dramatic moment, but I don't know. She just, like, delivers it with such unbridled excitement that I'm like, I really understand as horrible as a person as this movie presents her to be. Like, this moment of joy for her, so
she's really going for it. She's really, really excited. She's getting all the views, and people are participating. So, you know, I think that is an interesting sort of dynamic that's asked in the movie or whatever. Is that the, you know, like, what he's doing is not to sit at the TV and be mad, but actually, like, go out and yell that you're mad. And it's, like, taking a thing that's thought of as this passive viewership. And then, you know, I mean, as they make more obvious later when he starts doing the, like, waving hands and stuff, that he's, like, you know, more like a preacher than a newspaper person, that big church preachers have a kind of very participatory, like, especially evangelical ones, like, of singing and chanting and praise God and blah blah blah. And
becomes even more obvious when they take him off the news and give him his own the Howard Beale Hour, and they have, like, a huge stained glass window behind him.
Right.
They call him the Mad Prophet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Chayefsky, not known for his subtlety. That's it for me on Network. Do we want to move on to Bonnie and Clyde?
I just wanted to say the scene that I remember the most in this movie wasn't actually the Peter Finch speech. It was the Ned Beatty speech later in the movie, where Ned Beatty just sort of has
Peter really Finch alone
in the room, and it's, like, pointing and yelling at him very loudly. And I was like, God damn, that's a good speech.
That's another one that's shot really well, where, like, Howard Beale, who was, like, this kind of towering figure in his own show just becomes this very small man in a yeah. chair, and Satan's like, this is what you're going to do.
Yeah, because of my short time, I was, trying to cut it down to just my childhood, how I feel now, and then Faye Dunaway. But I will talk about that scene briefly, because it is either that scene or the breakup scene is the best directed scene in the movie. So it starts off where there's like overhead lights, like it's this big conference room with this long table, and they each have like individual lamps at like each desk, and he like turns off Ned Beatty's character, who's like the CEO. I'm a salesman, let me see if I can sell you something. Turns off the overhead lights, and so then it's just like these series of like almost like airplane lights, like a runway leading down to like Howard Beale's face. It's very disturbing. Both literally and metaphorically dark, unlike, say, Christopher Columbus's take on Chamber of Secrets, where he went literally dark but wasn't able to achieve any darkness of character or theme or plot. He was like, it's a darker film, so we got to turn off the lights. Darker book.
That's how we do it. Those shots also remind me very much of the way that Alan Pakula shoots stuff, especially in All the President's Men. Very similar, like kind of unnerving corporate quality.
Miss the big paranoid blockbusters of the 70s.
Yeah. Who was the
fun
DP for this movie? Do we know that? Because it could be the same.
Could be the same guy.
Yeah.
I'll get up. I've got the thing pulled up. Cinematographer Owen Reutzman. He did The Exorcist and The French Connection.
Ah.
3 Days of the Condor. Okay. But it doesn't look like he did
some other 70s Pacula classics
films.
But still, the visual vibe was in the air. People were people were creeped out. People were watching Billy Wilder and being like, offices look scary.
The hell of corporate America.
I'll go ahead and do Bonnie and Clyde, 67, Arthur Penn. I only saw this movie once or twice when I was a kid on VHS, but I definitely loved it at the time, and then hadn't seen it since. I thought that Faye Dunaway was extremely cool. I was like a really big Faye Dunaway fan. I saw this in Chinatown pretty close together, so I was like, Faye Dunaway. She's extremely good, extremely cool actor. And rewatching it this time, I liked it less. I found it a little bit corny. I found the editing a little bit jarring, a little bit ramshackle. And I couldn't tell always whether or not that was on purpose, but and then I also did not enjoy Warren Beatty's. I got confused because of Ned Beatty from but
the other famous Beatty.
Yeah, I didn't really like Warren Beatty's performance very much, or Gene Hackman's. Gene Hackman's an actor I usually love, but his doggy voice.
I agree with half of that.
Yeah.
That half.
The Gene Hackman half.
Yeah, and the woman who plays his wife, who I think either was nominated or won for this movie.
No, I think she was the only one who won of the group. It was one of the few Oscars that the movie won. But yeah, her performance is just a lot of screeching. Like when I read that, I was like, whoa, she's the winner? She's just like kind of half hysterical the whole movie. It's very one note. It's surprising that they're like, this is acting, this is what we want from a motion picture. But it's an interesting, funny contrast between this and Network. Bonnie and Clyde, in this, Bonnie's real horned up. She wants nothing but sex. She doesn't have time for anything else, and she's not getting it, and so she has to do her crime work in lieu of sex, as opposed to in the previous one we were talking about. She couldn't stop working even during sex, but in this, She can't get it, so she's got to kill people instead and rob banks. Sad.
Well, the killing people is sad, but the robbing banks thing.
Part that's sad is that she can't get laid. Oh,
yeah,
well. That's what
yeah, that
saying?
She can't get laid. That she has to have another act. Yeah, killing cops is good.
Sorry, I misunderstood.
Don't want to misspeak here. Killing cops is good. Robbing banks is good.
Yeah, I don't think they kill any innocent people unless you count the like bank teller or manager who runs after them to try to stop them, in which case that dude's a bootlicker.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
He's right.
Probably should have let that money go.
Yeah, he was after his bonus or whatever.
I mean, sure. Like, I definitely think one of the best scenes in the movie is when they're like, they either have been or they're going to stay at this house that's been condemned by the bank, and then the former owners show up and they think there's going to be a showdown, and they're like, "No, we just wanted to say goodbye to our house." And like, Clyde gives him his gun, and then they just like shoot at the foreclosed sign together. They make it very clear whose side they're on. I don't think that's accurate to the real Bonnie and Clyde, but, you know, this was the 60s, so you're making a political statement.
Yeah.
Yeah, they definitely, I don't think we're like the weird Robin Hood type of people.
No.
Just be like, ooh, I'm gonna steal all this money and give it back to all these people who are messed up and screwed over by the banks.
Yeah. But, if anything, we see that they're almost just as poor as if they'd had like a working class job. There are multiple scenes where either they rob a bank that has no money, or the bank is closed because the bank wasn't even making any money, or they get so little money that when they split it like five ways, that like Bonnie is very upset that Gene Hackman's wife gets any because she didn't do anything and in fact messed up the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think actually, based on what I read, that is also actually true to life, that they were living in relative poverty for almost the entire time, and that the amount of banks that they robbed was pumped up by the
FBI.
Yeah, and by the media and stuff like that surrounding it, that they... I think I read even that there may have been some places where, like, people who worked at the bank stole money and then claimed that Bonnie and Clyde robbed them. Pretty fucked up.
Classic.
A little unfair to Bonnie and Clyde, but, you know, steal from the banks, that's good.
Yeah, but employees embezzling, that's white-collar crime. I'm not down with that. Those people in prison.
All right. Yeah. Start to cross a weird line there.
As long as they're stealing from the government or rich people, I'm fine with it. Once they become rich themselves via embezzling and fraud, then you should steal from them. But before that point, it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was thinking that it was probably like bank managers or something like that. Something like what happens in Stagecoach, where that guy embezzles from his own bank or whatever.
As long as I think this would the FDIC, I don't think it existed because it was like after the Depression, so that might be bad because they might be taking money from
the actual
customers'
people.
Pockets as opposed to from the some government. Big bank company the or the insurance. Government. Mm-hmm. That's not right.
Indeed. I don't. This one, because I wasn't super crazy about it, I don't have a lot to say now because I felt, you know, I feel like when we first recorded this I had the least to say, and I meant to rewatch it in the interim and then I forgot to, so that's basically all I have to say. I know Ruben had a little more to say, maybe, at least last time.
I agree with you that what the quality of the editing is, but for whatever reason, it works for me because it's a very violent film in both. It's like actual literal violence and its ideology. Like it's not it doesn't pull punches in terms of like how bad the Great Depression was and in general how much the state and the bourgeois have monopoly on violence and money, wealth and power, respectively. And the cops never seem good in this movie. Like, there are a lot of sort of, it's like a faceless black swarm that's just like suddenly there and just like shooting shotguns into buildings over and over again. And so the sort of frenetic and sometimes like upsetting editing, like to me, adds to that feeling of being like complete lack of center, just like being thrown around while watching it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, how upsetting this movie is in content is matched with how upsetting I find watching it, where I feel unhinged.
That's cool.
And you know, like, Arthur Penn is not a director who's made anything since that, like, is super well regarded.
I think he did Night Moves, right?
Yeah, that's probably his next best regard. But even that is not like...
Yeah, it's not an AFI classic.
It's not like
classic.
Sidney Lumet or Roman Polanski, where they have like...
It's not an AFI list or anything.
Yeah, where they have like three stone cold classics or more, according to most people. And then like a litany of other like mildly good films. Like, yeah, Night Moves is his second... highest on Letterboxd, and then Little Big Man is number three.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
did
like,
he do The Miracle Worker?
Mm-hmm. And then...
That one was well-regarded at the time, but is one that time has kind of forgotten.
And I think, you know, there's probably what's good about this film is, like, due to its relative, like, its production... Like, and it's relatively small production for a movie that has, like, a couple big stars in it. I don't know how big they were at the time. I know Warren Beatty was already a big star, right? But Gene Hackman wasn't a big star at this time, was he?
No, I don't think Faye Dunaway was either. I think most of them is, like, relatively early in their career.
So it was probably a relatively cash-strapped picture. And some of the things that work about the movie, like... The violence for me is due to the nature of not having enough money to produce realistic violence, and so therefore having to create violence via editing and cinematography. And, like, you know, instead of, like, I don't know, having, like, realistic squibs or something, like having, like, a doll and then shooting it with, like, a Tommy gun, like, 1,000 times.
Yeah.
That something about that is, like, almost more upsetting than, like...
For sure.
Semi-realistic violence, and then maybe he wouldn't have done that if he had had more money or whatever. So
yeah, that it could have been. They might have done something a little more traditional.
So that would be my guess. I have never watched another Arthur Penn movie. After this, I'll probably watch Night Moves.
Yeah, I want to see that one.
If it's worth exploring his catalog at all, but
More Hackman, right?
Mm-hmm. He's
and I like
star
that song.
Now, the lead.
Sounds good as hell. All right. On to Chinatown then, unless you had something you wanted to say about Bonnie and Clyde real quick, Patrick.
I do not. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Yeah.
I agree with you about the scene where they shoot the foreclosure sign. I think that's like a linchpin scene in the movie. It's basically the thesis statement of the film, if you will. It's like, yeah, we're here for the people. We're not here for this, you know, fucking state apparatus or whatever.
That scene and the scene towards the very beginning where Clyde pulls his gun out and you can see Bonnie's like entire expression change, where she's like intrigued and scared and she like wants to touch it and it's like such an obvious penis.
She says, I bet you wouldn't have the gumption to use it. I think it's a great line to work the
That's what I was gonna say. That's you know, he pulled her into his scheme on false pretenses.
Yeah.
It turns out he's impotent or whatever. She's like, ooh, this is a guy with a gun. I could get down with that. And then he's
think in the original script, he was actually supposed to be bisexual.
Yeah, I think that's true to life, too. Yeah. I think that that's because mm-hmm. the reason that they bring that other guy into the gang, I think, was because that was he was in a relationship with Clyde.
Yeah, in the movie, he is his cousin. So.
Oh, or did you mean the driver guy? Because he's
not really. No, not Gene Hackman's character. Okay. The other guy. Yeah, the driver. Yeah. What's his name? Like
makes sense.
WC or something like that.
Yeah.
I forget what his name is.
I know ladies, man.
Yeah, but they decided that audiences at the time would reject the movie if he was explicitly mm-hmm. bisexual, so they went with impotent instead.
Until he sees
much more relatable.
until he gets in the paper, and then he's here for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't have much else to say about this movie.
Sure.
So we can go to my
Chinatown.
Chinatown from 1974. I will say that I'm trying to remember how long ago I did actually watch this, but I did watch this when I was younger. I think most.
Do you remember the first time you did?
I want to say it was sometime in college that I first saw it. Which college for me went all the way from like 2003 to like 2013. So college was a long time for me, actually.
Sure. Yeah.
but same. It was definitely one of those things too, where I was like, "Oh, it's on the AFI Top 100," and I was curious because like the name Chinatown like didn't really mean anything to me at the time. I was like, "What is this movie about? It seems kind of weird that it's the movie's name is Chinatown, and then it's seemingly about like a detective." So I was like intrigued by that aspect of it. And then just like, you know, Jack Nicholson always seems like an important actor to. I think I had also watched like One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest around that time, so I was like kind of interested in the other things that he had done. And yeah, I think the first time I watched this, I don't know if I fully grasped a lot of the stuff in it, but I could definitely like understand what was, I don't know, like what was kind of cool about it, but also like was a little put off by some of the stuff in it, because I was like, oh, this is like deeply dark for even considering like what a lot of the movies in the 70s did for like, you know, darkness and like going into these kind of icky places in American culture. And like this one goes to a really, really dark place. And I think I still think that today, because I've more than actually just watching the movie, like I've read the screenplay multiple times and have listened to like interviews that Robert Towne has given about it. And the, I guess sort of the controversy over how the ending of the movie actually turned out too, because Towne originally wrote it one way and then Polanski changed it so that it would be a different way. And I think I agree with Polanski's take on it, that it actually like increases the power of the movie, the way that it ends.
Because how was it supposed to end? Were they supposed to get away?
It's supposed to end where I think Faye Dunaway's character shoots Noah Cross
at the end
in the confrontation in Chinatown. And then they, you know, they get away, but she gets away, but Jake stays behind, I think is what happens.
Be the fall guy for
the original. For shooting Noah Cross, I think is the original ending. And then Polanski changed it to what it is now.
Yeah, I think that the movie definitely wouldn't be the same if it, because that's a much more traditional kind of Hollywood ending, and then like Jake gets his kind of redemptive moment after being kind of a shit heel the whole movie. Like finally he gets to do the right thing and become, you know, the cop that he wished he was back when he was a real cop and all that. I think that, you know, it's much more horrifying, the idea of like, no, there's literally nothing regular people can do. Like, the people with the money get to do whatever they want whenever they want, and you can't stop them.
Yeah, and I think also I guess it's the line that everyone points to as being the sort of linchpin of the philosophy of this movie, but when he's talking to, when Jake is talking to Noah Cross, And he says, like, what are you doing this for? Like, what else can you possibly buy? Like, how much better can you eat? And he says, the future, Mr. Gitz. And it's like, he doesn't just want to, like, live his life in comfort. Like, he just wants to own the entire future. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, that's that, like...
I think that's the way the audience is supposed to read the line, but the way that his character delivers the line and the way that he's pretending like he's doing it for the future of L.A. He's like, I want Los Angeles to be a big, you know, expansive, beautiful, prosperous city. And sometimes you have to be like me. You have to do immoral things in order to set up that the future is is right.
Well, that's even darker. I hadn't read it that way before. But yeah.
I mean, he says at one point, you know, which is like a very dark line, especially when you think of it in relationship to Roman Polanski. He says, like, you know, something along the lines of, like, everyone thinks they're a good person until they're in a situation where they realize how far they're actually willing to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think that it's interesting in the sense that, in a way, it could still more or less be both, like, you know, that the Jeff Bezoses of the world and stuff like that. But when they imagine the future, they're imagining a future that's very grateful for them for making the future that way. It's like, ooh, people are going to remember that the world is this way because of me.
Yeah,
it's a very fascistic superhero fantasy, I think, where they don't even realize that, like, you know, like... you know, it's, for instance, to use what's in the news right now, for a long time I thought that Bill Gates was a good person because he made a bunch of money, and in my head for a long time I was like, oh, well, he made a bunch of money, you know, just by coming up with this great product and then selling it well. And so then he has a ton of money. He just, like, gives so much of it away. Supposedly. But even if that were the case, if you were to ignore all of the offenses that Microsoft has done over the years in order to make that money, you're still building a system in which the rich make the decisions over what charity is and what humanitarian crises get served, as opposed to the majority of people.
Yeah, and it's like a monetary donation that shapes policy or whatever. Like, he donates to schools a lot, but then in turn schools use money to, like, buy Microsoft products and stuff. It's
Yeah, and people always talk about, like, Steve Jobs with that kind of reverence too, where it's like, oh, he gave the world all these things. And it's like, he didn't, first of all, like, didn't actually give the world all that stuff. Like, his whole thing was marketing the products that were made by the company already. But secondly, like, he's doing that to enrich himself. Like, he acts like it's, you know, we're coming to some, like, great human discovery moment, and, like, everything's going to be better for everybody because we put out this product. But, like, it's only to enrich, you know, his self and his company. And it's not, you know, there's no, like, altruism behind that. Like, there's no, like, great and glorious human future that he's actually serving other than his pocketbook.
My point is that I agree with you, but that I think even the charitable reading of Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, where they really did something great and deserved the money that they got, that the level of power that comes with that is not okay to have, even if they were Malcolm X or Martin Luther King Jr., as opposed to, you know...
Just a greedy capitalist.
Yeah, just capitalists. Who walked into their wealth.
Spending money to decide what the future looks like. One person making it happen.
I just want to briefly do my best to sort of paraphrase what I remember Ilya saying. I might even go through his audio if he still has it and see if I can, like, I don't know, add like a greatest hits to the end of this podcast. But his sort of opinion was that this is like an instant five-star classic for him. that it's one of the more upsetting films that he's seen sort of like in every corner from its look at, you know, gender and sexuality and women to wealth, as we've already been discussing, and, you know, law enforcement.
Bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy, the government.
Yeah, it's crazy that one of
how the sausage gets made.
Greatest movies of all time is just like a fight about water rights.
Yeah.
That he found the scene where Geddes is getting a shave and a haircut very interesting, where this one guy is, you know, giving him a hard time because he's like, look at this, your disgusting job in the media, how you've like put this person's affairs all, and Geddes is like very, it's very important to him that he does honest work, so he's like getting mad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this other guy, and that both Ilya and I noticed this time around, that that guy's in like bank loans. So basically, at the time, he's repossessing everyone's houses. So, in terms of disgusting work, he's doing much more disgusting work than whatever you think of J.J. Geddes's very little individualistic PI seediness. Which we know is not a good job, as we see at the end of the movie when he's helped by his first client to help him escape. We see that his wife has a big black eye because that was the end result of him revealing that she was having an affair, is domestic violence. So no one is really clean in this movie.
Yeah, Faye Dunaway and her daughter are kind of as close as it gets, but
yeah,
maybe
her daughter is probably the most innocent one. Faye Dunaway still riding horses and living in a giant mansion filled with, that they fill with like water every day and during a drought.
During the drought. Yeah, there's so many little details to this movie too, like that, and God, that's just like constant. I like that this movie does not shy away from the just like constant racism too, because it's like constant little racism just anywhere and everywhere. Like I always think about that scene where he goes to the nursing home to like find the people whose names are on all of the, you know, like the land holdings or whatever. And he
a very rich woman.
Yeah, he walks up he walks up to the guy at the front and he's like, do y'all serve people of the Jewish persuasion? He goes, no. And he's like, thank God. It's like, it's a throwaway joke, but it's also that like just constant underscore of racism where they're like, yeah, everybody was racist at this time. Like everybody across the board, no one gets away from it. It's like everywhere. And I was like, that's good. Like, it's not one of those movies that's trying to sort of, like, go back and, like, scrub, you know, any of the, like, personalities of these people clean and make them, you know, palatable to a modern audience. It's like, yeah, this is a terrible time with a lot of terrible people doing terrible things.
Yeah, the 30s and 40s, not so cool. That's something that I feel like noir has, you know, that... with a lot of the 60s and 70s kind of genre revisionism was about that. And then for a long time afterwards, we got away from that. It was like, ooh, they look really cool. It's really stylish. I like it.
Yeah.
But the political aspect was abandoned for a long time.
That leads us neatly into what I thought was one of my minor complaints about this movie, why it didn't work as well for me as it did when I was younger, which is that I think the movie recognizes how rich white people use spaces, people of color, to do their seedy work in order to separate themselves from it, but it's uncommented on. It's just like presented, you know, the same way that Noah Cross, Joan Houston's character, sees the future. Like, this is just the reality of the situation. And, you know, the whole movie being called, like, Chinatown, and then starring this white guy who's, like, pretty overtly racist most of the movie, even though, like, I wouldn't say we're supposed to like him, but by the end of the movie, we're, you know, we're rooting for him to get her out of there.
Right.
Because of how horrible the situation is that, like, I guess even my most charitable reading of it is this idea of being like, well, sometimes you gotta be racist to do something good somewhere else. Like, that, you know, the fact that, I can't remember Faye Dunaway's character's name.
Evelyn.
Evelyn.
Evelyn Mulray.
And her daughter are, like, running away to Mexico is just sort of like, that's what you do when you're a white person in trouble. You go hide among the POC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, it just feels a little off to me. So, yeah. But that's going to be it for me on this podcast. So,
well, I don't have anything to say. It's been the longest since I've seen it, so we can go ahead and just wrap it up.
I mean, I think if you can remember it at all, the two of you should talk about Faye Dunaway's performance in the movie at least a little bit, but I got to get ready for work.
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
Off to workies. Bye, Ruben.
All right. See ya. All right. So, I mean, the thing I remember most about this movie, and again, like, I don't know if this is necessarily a performance moment, but it's the, the one that I think about when I think about her in this movie is the part where he's, they're in bed together and he's looking into her eyes and he says, one of your eyes has an imperfection in it. And that is the same eye that she gets shot through.
Oh boy.
Later in the movie. Yikes. And it's just... I think it's more of a screenplay moment because most of what I remember in this movie is screenplay based now because I've read it so many times. And so I'm always like clued into those little things that come back later.
But,
yeah. But I also think it's interesting looking at this. I think there was a point in time where I actually did watch like back to back Bonnie and Clyde and this movie and looking at how much she changes from, you know, not a full decade before, but like, you know, several years before in Bonnie and Clyde to this movie. And I don't know, it always struck me as a really sad performance, which I guess makes sense for the character. But there's also moments where you're like genuinely like scared of her too. Like the first time that she shows up in his office after he's taken the pictures for the fake Evelyn Mulray. And she like shows up behind him and is just like looking really stern as he's telling this racist joke to his colleagues.
Right.
Yeah. I kind of liked that she was able to go to those extremes where she's like at times scary in her own right, but then other times like extremely vulnerable and sad. And,
I think an interesting thing about her in general, like this movie for a lot of it and especially in Network, I think that she has a kind of like nervous manic energy that she taps into really well in her performances so that like when she's on edge, you have a real sense of like a person like on the brink and like really going for it. And I feel like she's able to pull off that kind of acting very well, and I guess that's part of how you know that's riding a fine line, because obviously her performance in Mommy Dearest is sort of infamous for going a little too far in that direction and becoming kind of like a camp thing, but in these previous movies like she's able to kind of walk that line really well, and it makes for affecting moments. Feel real bad, but I didn't have too much more else to say. Unfortunately, I meant to rewatch it yesterday before I had to go to work, but then I forgot we were doing this podcast until I got home from work, and I was like, oops, I guess I don't have time to watch Chinatown.
Yeah, I had set everything up in here for Ruben because I thought I was going to be not on this podcast at all, and he was going to do it himself, so.
Yeah, good old Ilya had to get stuck at work.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
It is, but yeah, hopefully Ruben can splice in some of that stuff so people can get a glimpse of what Ilya said, because I remember liking it a lot, but it, like I said, it's been a little while, so Ruben remembered a little better than me, but yeah, got a little slightly shorter episode this time, but I feel like that works out.
Yeah, and I would also say, like, this is, I believe it's still in my top 10. If it's not, it's just outside or something like that. Nice. But yeah, this has always been, like, as far as, like, screenplays go, like, it's one of the ones that I always tell people, like, look at that screenplay and, like, the way that it takes care to, like, set up details at the beginning that, like, pay off really well at the end. And it, like, does all these neat things with the character development where you really get a good sense of all of the characters through details. Like, they don't outright state them for you. It's all all in these details of the way that they talk to people and the way that their dealings go and all of the
cumulative effect.
Yeah, and the way that the mystery unfolds too, because I like the way that the mystery is, like, very sort of woven into these kind of mundane, like, everyday things going on, like this, you know, this town meeting where all this, you know, goofy stuff is happening and people are shouting and the guy brings cows in and, you know, it's like this crazy thing, but then there's, like, these big, you know, clues as to what's going on being dropped in all of the details of what's happening. And, you know, I love a good, you know, like, a movie that's, like, about this really kind of mundane thing, like water rights, but then it also is actually about, you know, the future of Los Angeles and, like, the, you know, class distinctions. And I like those macro, micro themes and motifs that they can paint on everything.
Maybe it also reminds me of, even though I think it's not as good a movie, but Gangs of New York has a similar vibe of, like, this, you know, monumental historic city that people live in and love. It was just, like, built on disgusting bloodshed and terrible things. There's no actually great city that exists, because every single city was probably built on horrible politics and oppression.
Yeah,
it's a bummer. Yeah. I like LA.
I do too. I think I've been the most, like, active, like, LA stan on this podcast for sure.
Yeah, every time I've been, I've liked it a lot. It's definitely a place I would move to if I was ever going to leave Portland. But, I mean, you know, not that Portland's great. Portland's got its own terrible, seedy, awful history. So.
Yep, as does Birmingham. I guess everywhere. But yeah, I think that's everything.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for subbing in.
Yeah, short notice. Problem. Enjoyed it. Yeah, well, if you enjoyed listening to us on this podcast, you can visit us at www.fancyfilmfellows.com. You can also find us on Spotify. You can find us on Apple Music. You can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on whatever podcast aggregating service you use. And next time I think we're going to be talking about, is it a reading and watching we're doing next?
No, I think the next one is going to be the spitball, where we're just going to talk generally about performers, about
performers. Yeah, we're all going to have our own
acting.
Yeah, we're all going to have our own performers that we watched a bunch of movies from. We're going to sit around and talk about acting and performances in movies. So that'll be fun. We'll have a
All right.
Well, I think that's it.
Bye.
I think, as Ruben says, I think we nailed it.
Yeah.
Bye.